This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for being with us for Talk Louisiana. Robin Dow is our producer, and our signature sponsor is First Financial Tax and Accounting Services. The Executive Vice President of the Baton Rouge Area Foundation is in the house, John Spain, coming up on 20 years in that post. And he has some major projects of interest to our community, but his backstory is compelling, and a year is incomplete without visiting once, at least once, with John Spain. And he goes back a few years before I, not too many, but a few, at the Manship School, which was in the LSU Journalism School, and started his career, as did I, at WLSU. And I'm sure those were formative years for you.
They were. And radio introduced us to news and to broadcasting, and I fell in love with it early. And I worked at the LSU and then went to WLCS. And back those days was the number one AM station in town. FM really hadn't been discovered in those early days. And so it was a rock number one radio station in the city. And as a college kid, it helped pay my way through college.
And as it happened, there was a fire at the station, which changed your life and career, correct?
Yeah, we've just talked about that. There was a studio fire. And as many people will know, that tall tower behind Channel 2 TV on Highland Road also was the place where we had our transmitter. So with the studio out of business, we were broadcasting from a little brick building behind Channel 2, and I would have to go out and do radio there and use the back door to enter the TV station to go to the restroom and get some snacks. And the course of having been there, I came across the news director at the time, Al Crouch, and we started up a conversation and told him I was in journalism school at LSU, wanted a career in broadcasting, and ultimately he offered me my first television job, which was weekend weatherman and a reporter, which was the only job, and I took it. And fairly soon in that relationship, we discovered I didn't know much about weather and eventually became a full-time news reporter.
And you loved the news. I remember reading Dan Rather's autobiography, and he said he would have been happy at the assignments desk in McAllen, Texas, because he loved the news. And of course, many reporters don't, but you did. And I think that's what was the catalyst for a substantial career. Very young. You were in your 20s when you were news director at the top TV station in Baton Rouge at the time.
I was. And I had a remarkable career. Thanks to the leadership, going back all the way to Doug Manship and Richard and the family, always believed that news was important. And we surrounded ourselves with good people who came and participated in our program there. You know, the height of that was winning two Peabody Awards, which for your readers, listeners, was the equivalent of a Pulitzer Prize for broadcasting, right. And with John Camp and a team of people surrounding him, we won two of those, which is really still unheard of in our market size.
Mm-hmm. I remember in 1986, it was a big thrill for me. I'd never been hobnobbing with big-time journalists, but I was in Orlando, Florida for what was then the 15th anniversary of Disney World, and there's this meeting of all these major journalists across the country, and there the MC is John Spain.
That's right.
You would have been 37 years old at the time, but you were president of the National Radio and Television News Directors Association.
That's correct. RTNDA at the time was the international association where journalists in broadcasting were. It was our association. There were people at that convention from all over the world. And I had served on the board for a while and was very privileged to be the president of the association.
And you got to be known nationwide as a result of that. And we've talked about this before, and I think it's worth mentioning that in the 70s, WBRZ and early 80s, I guess, you were on the cutting edge. You had equipment, which was, of course, vital. It still is, but then more so than now. You can go on the air now on a shoestring budget. You couldn't then, but doing live shots and that sort of thing, you had things that stations in New York didn't have.
I give the Manship family credit for that. I remember walking through the halls of an annual convention looking at equipment, and Doug Manship was there, and there was something new called satellites, and you could spend a lot of money, get a satellite truck, and broadcast from anywhere. but you had to also pay a prorated share to own the satellite. And it was very, very expensive. And he spent about a half a day with us, and he said, yes, we're going to do that. He bought the satellite truck, paid the fee to be a part of a consortium that did it. We were still using typewriters. He walked in and said, I've converted the newspaper to computers. It's time you did, and we computerized the newsroom. So they were a believer in the technology, still are, that, you know, don't let the barrier of not having the technology get in the way of telling the story. And that equipment paid off many, many times by letting us go live literally anywhere in North America.
877-217-5757. And we've had people on this show who worked with you and for you. Michael Marsh last year talked about the Lynyrd Skynyrd crash in rural Mississippi. You were there and he was there. He was a young guy who I think was like the third or fourth choice to be the reporter, but he did a great job.
He did. And we literally owned that story by being there and with the equipment and the right people. And mm-hmm. we sent it around the world.
And then when Butch Baum's plane crashed in Shattuck, Oklahoma, the guy who was running for governor, famous insurance guy,
right?
He as far as media, he was the Gordon McKernan of his day. He
had billboards in Tiger Stadium.
That's right. The only one.
Exactly right.
The only one.
Exactly.
But he's on a flight to Shreveport, and it ends up going to Shattuck, Oklahoma, and crashing. And there was Barry Irwin on the scene.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So you know, those colleagues remain dear friends. We get together and did recently with about 20 of us that all served time at Channel 2 during those years and still stay in touch.
How has television news changed?
It's changed a lot. I still think we're blessed to have really good television news in Baton Rouge, better than most markets its size. And I give credit to the leadership, again, the Manship families at Channel 2, but also the folks across the other two stations still spend a fair amount of time and effort trying to do a good job on local news. It's changed a good bit. It's not as important in some stations across the country as it once was, and the staffs are smaller and younger and maybe less experienced. But I still believe Baton Rouge is different than most. I think there's still an understanding that this is a great news story town. It happens every day. Mm-hmm. It's a lot of news to cover, and generally speaking, we're blessed to have that.
Now, in the day in which you were news director at WBRZ and I was covering the Capitol, when the governor would leave his office or leave the mansion, there would be 20, 25 reporters around the governor. Today, John Bell can walk out of the mansion, there's nobody. That to me is the biggest change, is the paucity of people covering the news, which of course means that stories are missed, that if officials are up to no good, there's not as much vigilance. Your thoughts about that?
Yeah, we actually built a small newsroom in the basement of the Capitol, which was unheard of. And it was back before a lot of the equipment was available, but we actually staffed it. That was Barry, Bob Courtney, Brenda Hodge, all those people served as well. And they had the ability to, you know, stay there all day long and cover it. And we did a great job having, you know, Capitol coverage. The staffs were larger. You know, and they had a lot of people that, you know, could do that kind of stuff. When you come to John Camp, who was our investigative reporter, it was not uncommon that he would do two stories a year, but he had an entire staff that was doing research and doing the background on those stories, and those are the ones that got the national attention. But it's very hard to believe that station managers, owners today would allow someone on the payroll to do two stories a year.
That's true. He delivered. And also the kinds of stories he was doing invite litigation, and nothing scares owners more than being sued for any number of reasons.
Exactly right. Or even just a threat that you're going to be sued.
877-217-5757. And in our time this morning, we certainly will talk with John Spain about a couple of projects and maybe a few more, but the LSU Lakes and the rail system. Barry in Mid-City's been waiting for a moment or two. Barry, good morning. You're on with John Spain.
Good morning. Good morning, Jim and John. I'm wondering if you could comment, please, John, on the impact of the way news now is so available, like on Facebook, which I don't do, but I know it's there. And you can go on the internet or YouTube and so on. What is the impact, in your opinion, of the internet and these other areas where news is so widely available, please?
It's a mixed bag. I mean, having 24-hour access to news is important. And all of us are linked to various electronic devices that keep us in touch, and I think that's important. it's also a negative in trying to say that what you get off of some of those media outlets is actually news. There's not a lot of research on it. There's no credibility in some cases. I get on occasion invited to speak before journalism students around the country, and I ask them how many read the newspaper that morning. And I'm surprised that many of them didn't. Mm-hmm. And then when I ask them what are their news sources, how do they stay informed, they hold up their phones, and I say, show me the apps. And it's everything from ESPN to Facebook to any number of things. And in the old days, and it really was the old days, you know, we would read two or three newspapers, watch the newscast, and try to educate ourselves on what the issues of the day are. That's not a negative on today's generation. It's just that the technology has changed. You take advantage of what is available to you, and they do. But you have to be smart enough to know what is really news and what is not.
877-217-5757. We return with John Spain, Executive Vice President, Baton Rouge Area Foundation, in 90 seconds. This is Jim Engster. Thanks for being with us for Talk Louisiana. 877-217-5757. John Spain is with us, and he worked at WBRZ Channel 2 for many years, and we're talking early 70s to late 90s, and then went off to the Powell Group, and now almost 20 years as of July with the Baton Rouge Area Foundation. But a listener did note, and it's worthy of mentioning, these people of a certain age, including yours truly, we remember the likes of Ed Buggs and John Mahaffey and Jay Young. These were all anchors for you, and you've outlived them all. That must be a sobering thought.
I've been to all their funerals, and some of them were painful. But they were a good example of really, you know, really solid broadcasters, good reporters. Like all of us, they had their own personal challenges, and we were part of their lives and tried to support them as best we could. But we've got great memories of all those folks who were really stars in local television at the time. And I was blessed to have been surrounded by extraordinarily talented people.
Well, those three guys were extremely talented and could have worked in any market. And, of course, Jay did go off. He was one of the original anchors at CNN.
Yeah.
But all three of them, I think it's fair to say, had substance abuse issues.
They did. John Mahaffey was actually hired by Carlton Cremins to be on Channel 9 across the street. And we looked at that and over time said, wow, he's such a great talent. We need to bring him to Channel 2. And it was very controversial, but we sat down and had conversations, and John agreed to move across the street. And it proved to be a wonderful team of he and Ed Buggs.
What do you make of non-competes?
They weren't in place at the time, which allowed us to do that. And, of course, shortly after that, people started having non-competes that prohibited people from going from one station to the other in the same market. And now there's an actual official legislation being looked at to actually abolish those. I think you can argue it both ways. You know, if a station pays a lot of money, invest in marketing, that person put their name in the newspaper and on billboards and radio and promote them, you've made an investment on them, and you ought to be entitled to some kind of return on that investment. And, you know, it's also true that people should have the choice to go and move and work where they want to. But there's got to be a fine line between the two of those, so you balance the interest of the company versus the individual.
Well, unlike, I was looking the other day, and Jerry Stovall, when he was hired at LSU as head football coach, $42,000 a year.
It's hard to believe.
And Brian Kelly's like $12 million a year. The anchor people, they made pretty good money in 1980 relative to the general population, but today it hasn't changed a whole lot, has it?
I don't keep up with it, but the anecdotally what I hear from friends is that the salaries probably were better back then. I know that we had an advantage in hiring people because we paid much more lucrative salaries back then and could attract the people from what would normally have been a pathway to a larger market. They chose to stay in Baton Rouge because of the environment, the salary scales, and the equipment we mentioned earlier, and we could keep them. But yes, I would think that broadcasting in general across the board, probably in newsrooms, the salaries are fairly stagnant.
877-217-5757, and that brings us to some of the major projects John Spain has been involved with for a few years, and he has been the principal participant in attempting to get a rail system and using creative ways to make it happen from Baton Rouge to New Orleans and back. He was with us about 13 months ago. How's it going?
We're getting very close. It's interesting that the Biden administration, whether you like his politics or not, President Biden is often called Amtrak Joe. And it's a story that his first wife and one of his children were killed in an automobile accident. And he pledged that as long as he stayed in Congress, he would spend the night at home with the rest of his family. And as a result of that, he rode an Amtrak train each day.
And from Delaware to D.C.,
Washington. Yeah, and so the crews and the people that saw him every day just kind of gave him the nickname of Amtrak Joe. And it served a purpose for him, and you can understand that with the loss that it was very important to him to have a reliable way of transportation. As a result of that, in this infrastructure bill and the dollars that are out there, it's roughly $31 billion for inner-city rail. And that can be used for rail improvements and stations and any number of things. And there's also operating subsidies that can offset the cost of operating the train until they can start, you know, increasing the number of riders. Clearly in the year, first couple of years, we expect people to take some time to actually find this train and test it. But the good news is that Governor Edwards has supported the projects, and since he ran for office, he still does. Amtrak, the president of Amtrak, the president of the Federal Railroad Administration, everybody that's involved has ridden a train from Baton Rouge, New Orleans with the governor. And they've all gotten off the train and said, we're going to do it. So all the parties are aligned. And the money is there. And so for the infrastructure improvements that need to be made, the state is applying and will continue to apply for federal dollars to improve things such as the Bonnie Carey Spillway Bridge. And Amtrak has said that they need about 6 months' notice to put together the equipment and crews in order to start the service. And as a result of all of this energy around the Baton Rouge-New Orleans project, we're very excited to know that other parts of the state are now really, really interested in rail. So there's an entire delegation of lawmakers and mayors across the I-20 that want to see train service from Dallas to Atlanta, which would include Shreveport, Ruston, Monroe. We have worked on a project from New Orleans to Mobile. That service was stopped after Katrina, and that train will start this year. And eventually it will go from Mobile to Orlando, connecting two great American entertainment centers. New Orleans and Orlando will have a train between them. And not so far in the future, we're going to have the funding to provide an additional study for Baton Rouge to Shreveport. And the state has been talking about connecting North and South Louisiana for decades. And a rail service could do that. So you look long-term and think about it as Dallas to New Orleans.
Well, this morning at Louis, a couple of gentlemen who knew you were going to be on this show said you recently, you went on a train to Washington, did you?
It was not my idea, but it was a fascinating opportunity. So the Speaker of the House, Clay Shake-Snyder, and 10 other lawmakers decided if they were going to go to Washington for the Mardi Gras ball, they'd ride the train. And actually, Amtrak called me and said, do you know anything about it? I said, no, but I'm very interested in it. And so I called the Speaker's office and said, would you mind if I kind of got involved and some other folks, you know, wanted to ride with them? And so that happened. Amtrak did a really nice job. They put a one-of-a-kind car on the end of the train set called the inspection car, a theater car. And it's a car that's got glass across the back and, you know, stadium seating. And Amtrak then had a vice president travel with us, and so we had an opportunity to talk to those lawmakers about passenger rail and why it's important. It was a lot of fun, and I hope it was informative.
A listener asked, how long will the trip be? We're not talking high-speed rail here, but it would be, first of all, you don't have the worries of driving and parking, but would you get there faster by train than by car?
Baton Rouge, New Orleans, the train would be an hour and 15, 20 minutes.
About the same.
We kind of say, yeah, you know, we can do that. What I tell people is the train would be predictable. You know, I think you can probably get to the New Orleans airport a little over an hour, but on a given date and time, it might take you another 45 minutes to go downtown. When you get on the train, you're going to know basically here's how much time it takes. And the other thing is you can be productive. Oftentimes, I rode a train in Florida last year, and there was a lady across the aisle. I asked her why she was on the train. She said she was a lawyer. And she was riding to see a client from West Palm to Miami. And she said, with a smile, I can bill my time going down. I'll bill my time with my client and bill the 2 hours back. And it's a productive use of time. She could have driven it. But you don't know when there's going to be an accident or there's going to be a traffic congestion, particularly on I-10 now. So it's predictable. And I think people will use it. One of the other things that's important is one of the stops will be at Louis Armstrong. And a significant number of people in the Capital Region now fly out of that airport. Not that we don't have really good service here, we do, but there are occasions when you want direct flights and less expensive flights. And so Louis Armstrong, I think, will be a major part of this train service.
What will the cost be?
We don't know yet. When we estimated that in 2014 it was going to be $15 each way, I'm sure it's going to be a little bit more than that. When you look at just what it costs to park a car at the airport, you know, I think this will be very, very competitive. And we've got an update on that study coming where we can price it, but it's got to be reasonable or people won't use it.
One more segment with John Spain, 877-217-5757 is your Talk Louisiana number. Robin Dow's at the controls, and we're back after this brief pause. This is Jim Engster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. John Spain is with us for another segment, the Executive Vice President of the Baton Rouge Area Foundation. Now, he comes up on 20 years in July, and John is a driver. I don't think he'll ever retire, but as far as full-time work, I know the number. You were born in 1948, albeit very late in the year. So
you had to say that.
Very late in the year. But, and you had a heart attack when you were 45 years old, and it's amazing that...
No, hold on. I never had a heart attack, and it was in my mid-30s, which makes it even worse, but I had a big Thanksgiving lunch one day and didn't feel very well and ultimately went to the hospital, and I had serious blockage, so I did a double bypass, but I was very lucky that I'd never had a heart attack.
Well, yeah, so. You might not have...
Yeah.
Most people who have heart attacks don't make it to the...
Certainly in their 30s, no.
No. Well, you came back strong, as they say. That's half a lifetime ago or more. So
yeah.
you've done it. But as I tell people of a certain vintage, and now I'm in that number too, and by a pretty good margin, we're a lot closer to the end than we are the beginning, John. So what's next? You going to stay around a while?
Yeah. I'm really blessed that we've got new leadership at the Baton Rouge Area Foundation. Chris Myers, our new president and CEO, and the staff has just gone through 9 months of looking at the work of the foundation, reflecting on it, and coming up with an action plan. And we're really excited about some of the things that will come out of that. I think it brings the foundation back closer to the community. We've talked about and did engage with probably 200 or more meetings with nonprofits, people in the community about what they want to do. And I think in addition to the projects we've talked about here this morning, there will be more engagement. I think we're going to look at how do we provide early childhood education, working with partners. That's such a critical issue. Looking at how do we deal with the climate change and its impact on particularly people living in lower economic status. You know, can we help them in terms of weatherizing homes and bringing those homes up to date? I think we want to look at how we continue to make significant impact in people's lives in the region. And we have ongoing conversations that talk about not only our work in Baton Rouge, but over the years we've created community foundations on the North Shore and Lake Charles, and we'd like to replicate those statewide so that we have a network of foundations doing this kind of work. So I'm very excited about the new leadership, the new opportunities the foundation's going to have. I'm grateful that people, literally hundreds, have participated in the process and told us what they think is important. And so the work of the foundation will go forward. I look forward to being a part of it.
Boo on Acadian. Boo, you're on with John Spain.
Well, good morning. John, as you and I worked together on the rail project, one of the things we said is we wanted this train to be active before we died. Do you think that's a possibility now?
Good morning, Boo Thomas, and I'm hoping that that's the last conversation we're going to talk about how old we all are and dying, because, yes, the train's going to run, and it's going to run, I hope, in the near future. As I said a moment ago, there's all the pieces are there. We need to have the state enter into an operating contract with Amtrak, and I think that's the next step. And once that's in place, then I think Amtrak can start planning to put the equipment and people in place. And we've had the opportunity to build relationships with the president of Amtrak. We had those conversations while we were in Washington last week. And I think we're very close. And I know I've said that, but I think all the parties have publicly agreed, had press conferences saying they're going to do it. I very much appreciate the governor's leadership on it. I think it's going to happen, along with Secretary Wilson at DOTD, who's been a champion for it as well.
Carol in Jefferson Terrace. Hello, Carol. You're on with John Spain.
Yes, I want to thank you for pushing the trains. As a big problem I see with it is public opinion. I don't know how we're going to change that. For about, over 2 years, I live within walking distance of the Northeast Corridor. And that is not, that is so liberating to be able to get a monthly pass and not worry about snow removal or anything. Just go get on it and go.
Yeah, I think the Northeast Corridor is the one place in America where we still have the high-speed Acela train, and it's a different model. We looked at true high speed, which would be 100, 150 miles an hour between Baton Rouge and New Orleans, but it's only a 90-mile run. So this train will operate probably at 80, 85 miles an hour. And as we said earlier, without any obstructions, and so the arrival time is going to be very predictable, we think. I think people have to ride it. I think people forget that we used to have trains on this very track. Back in the 60s, we had lots of passenger service in Louisiana. But this generation hasn't ridden a train. I think when they will, I think they'll appreciate how efficient it is. And I think it will be received favorably. We've actually polled this issue several times over the years. And generally speaking, the people who responded to the polls, about 75 to 80% said they were excited about it.
Randy and Zachary. Randy, you're on with John.
Yes, well, I'm all aboard on the train. I think it's a wonderful idea. And something I've been, this kind of dawned on me, that were you around when the Jim Leslie story?
Yes, sir, I was.
You were working, that was 76, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, July 1976.
Yeah, very close to the station.
Yeah, Prince Murat.
Yeah, right behind the building.
And at first it was thought to be a union hit job, and it wasn't.
That's right. We were in the midst of a very heated debate in the state over right-to-work legislation at the time. And Jim was from Shreveport, as I recall, and was very much involved in that conversation. And just the coincidence of his death and the way he died led people to believe it was part of that right-to-work debate. But we ultimately knew that that wasn't the case.
Leonard in Lafayette. Leonard, you're on with John. Hi, Leonard.
Have you given any thought to the connection between Baton Rouge and Lafayette?
Yeah, the Amtrak service currently runs, Sunset Limited runs from the West Coast to the East Coast, except when it came to Baton Rouge, the tracks were destroyed along the Mississippi Gulf Coast in Katrina. And the Sunset was generally not very dependable east of Baton Rouge, which is why when we started it back up, we said, let's don't make it the Sunset, let's start a new route. And at better times. But Amtrak does do a service all the way to the West Coast from Lafayette, from New Orleans all the way across. And a couple of years ago, I took my grandkids. We got on it in Lafayette, rode it to San Antonio. I would tell people to do it. It's a fun ride. You can go see the Alamo and some other things. But we did use it, and we want that service to continue and hopefully with better times.
Patrick in Insualdo States. Hello, Patrick.
Hey, I guess the last time I checked, the year's not 1875. People don't use trains anymore. And you can use a bus to do what a train does. And it can change course and go different places. I hate to break it to you, but nobody's going to use this train.
Well, everybody's entitled to their opinion. You know, one of the things we think about, there's roughly, according to our studies, about 1,500 people in New Orleans that work in Baton Rouge every day, and about 1,500 work in Baton Rouge go to New Orleans every day. And you look at the congestion on I-10 between our two cities, if we just got some portion of that, we could reduce some of the congestion, and that would help. And I agree that not everybody will take a train. It's not designed to do, you know, something for everyone, but we do think the ridership will be there.
My friend, Dr. Mike Futrell, told me that he sometimes rides a train to Chicago, just likes to ride the train, gets off, spends a day there, and comes back.
City of New Orleans services from New Orleans, Chicago. It's a great ride. My wife and I did it a few years ago.
Yeah,
I do want to talk about lakes before we leave.
Well, we got. Yeah, I'm looking at a headline in The Advocate, October 6th, LSU lakes work quietly progressing. You're trying to get more attention, and for good reason, but it is progressing, I hear.
Yeah. Back in 2008, the Corps of Engineers did a study on the lakes. You know how many lakes there are, Jim?
No, how many? How many are there?
How many do you think?
How many lakes at LSU?
Yeah, yeah.
Seven.
Well, you're closer than most. There are actually six. Most people guess four, but there are a couple that get lost in that. So the Corps basically said in 08 that they're dying. And in 2014, we convened everyone and said, are you all going to do something? And everybody said, no, we need some leadership. So basically the foundation invested its time and money and put a master plan together for the restoration of them. What most people don't understand is those lakes, in many cases, are about 2 feet deep. And as a result of that shallowness, it creates the green algae and things on the lakes that we see. We finished the study, and then we met with the owners and the participants, and that was the City of Baton Rouge, LSU, the state, BREC, all agreed that we needed to do something. We never thought for a moment that we were qualified to do this part of the construction, and so we turned to our friends at the LSU Foundation, and they're now in charge of that. I still stay involved as a project management committee. And where we are, and I'm happy to tell you that sometime in February, March, we're still waiting on approval from the Corps. The heavy equipment will go into City Park Lake, and we'll start dredging those lakes. The other exciting piece that I think a lot of people haven't heard of is that we'll build a bridge at May Street. Now, we'd all ride on May Street. It's that narrow street between City Park Lake
and University. Where John Ferguson used to live.
Exactly right, Joe. Having a bridge there will allow us to connect City Park, University Lake, and more importantly, let, you know, recreational canoeing, kayaking, rowing to actually take place between the lakes. We're very excited about that. I appreciate the leadership of the LSU Foundation. Breck, the mayor, Broom, has been a champion on this thing, as has Governor Edwards. So it's real, and you'll see, you know, some of the remedial work start literally in the next 60 days, we think. It'll take a couple of years to actually finish it, but they will all be done and they'll all be healthy, and we'll be pleased with them. I often refer to them as the crown jewels of this city.
Well,
and if you didn't have them, what would we
have?
Well,
and think of what LSU would look like without those lakes.
Yes.
And you're a graduate, and you certainly have an affiliation with this city. I know it's something that is a personal matter to you.
I love this city, and I've been blessed with a number of different careers, as we briefly talked about here today, and I love hopefully being a part with lots of other people of addressing some of these challenges that we have. And I've had parents and students talk about the LSU lakes and their history of just sitting out there and watching it. I've had parents say that the lakes were one of the things that attracted them to LSU because it's such a beautiful natural environment there. So it's important that we protect them. And we will, and the project is in good hands under the LSU Foundations with Rob Stewart and his team there. So I'm very confident we're going to get it done, and the funding's there. So we finally are going to get them done.
Let's make a date to have you back this summer if you'll do it.
We'll do it. I always appreciate the opportunity to thank those listeners for their questions.
And you're one of the best, and he's a Baton Rougean, John Spain. We're back after this. This is Jim Inkster. Glad you're with us for Talk Louisiana, and treat this last quarter hour remembering the great Ernest Gaines, a writer like none other, who called Louisiana home as a young man and returned as an older man and logged the last 35 years of his life in his home state. He had to leave here in his formative years when he was a teenager in the late 40s because there were not educational opportunities, went to Vallejo, California. Today there's a fine editorial, one of the best I've read in a while, and there's some good ones. Lanny Keller does pretty good work, by the way, with The Advocate, but about Ernest Gaines and about what happened on the 23rd of January, 8 days after Ernest's 90th birthday. Call this a gathering of old friends is how it begins. More than 400 people made their way to the University of Louisiana at Lafayette last week to unveil the Black Heritage Stamp that bears the image of Ernest J. Gaines, captured in brilliant color. It will forever honor this Louisiana native and writer, the author of The Autobiography of Miss Jane Pittman, A Lesson Before Dying, and a half dozen other novels, including A Gathering of Old Men. He was remembered by those who treasured him for his books, his lectures, his insights, colleagues, students, scholars, fellow writers, readers, family, and the curious. Hundreds attended the sort of ceremony that sometimes draws, but a few dozen people on the first day a stamp is issued. Ernest was beloved by anybody who ever knew him, and I was privileged to be in his company many times over the last several years of his life with his beautiful wife, Diane, who keeps the flame going. And Louisiana was blessed to have him as a native, and even more blessed to have him return. And he ended his life where it all began, in Oscar, Louisiana, right on False River, and left a mark on our culture that is indelible. But what brought him back to Louisiana, he became the writer in residence at then University of Southwestern Louisiana, and he lived in a house not far from the campus, and there is now the Ernest J. Gaines Center at ULL, appropriately, and with us is the director, Shailen Woods. And good morning to you, Shailen Woods.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm doing well. And you're a younger person, but you know the legacy of Ernest Gaines, and you found out about it in another state. And what was the first book you read from Ernest?
The first book I read was A Lesson Before Dying, which was one of the books through the National Endowment of the Humanities Project was made very accessible to students across the country, and through the Big Reads program, that was the book selected in the 90s as the Big Reads book for a year.
Well, Shailen is the archivist of the Ernest J. Gaines Center and the director, and for those unfamiliar, it is located on the campus at UL Lafayette. And she's actively working to assist in the preservation of rural African American communities and the stories of those who preceded us. And Ernest Gaines is one of the biggest stories of them all. I think, Shailen, his words will be quoted and remembered and revered centuries after you and I are gone, and you're younger than I, but they are everlasting, aren't they?
Absolutely. That is most definitely the hope, that no matter what, the value of his work and his life legacy, which was to work to document and preserve and share and just provide a different view of rural Southern blackness, specifically from South Louisiana, that will continue regardless of who's here, who's at the center, or who's not at the center. That's the work we're striving for here, to make sure that we are doing the best we can to share Gaines's life and legacy with as many people as possible.
For those who'd like to come by and look around and see what's there, what's the best way to contact you about visiting the Gaines Center?
The best way to contact me would be by my email. It's cheylon.woods, W-O-O-D-S, at louisiana.edu. On the Ernest J. Gaines Center website, we do have a form that anyone can fill out if they're interested in a tour of the Gaines Center. We are normally open Monday through Friday, but we'll be more than happy to schedule class tour Saturday tours as necessary.
All right, a listener, this is Sally in Lafayette, mentions that you have a blog about the work of Ernest Gaines. Tell us more about this.
Yes, we on the Gaines Center's website, we have an academic blog. And the reason we started the academic blog is because we are an international research center, and a lot of people don't understand how difficult it is for people in other countries to get access to the databases our students have here. So we started working with researchers all over the world to write 1,000-word blogs that we could share Gaines's work and different ways his work intersects with other things like agriculture or women's studies, community studies, literature, anything that relates to their research. And it also gives us an opportunity to highlight the work of other scholars, especially younger scholars. We do work with our own students at UL who are in the Gaines Center to write blogs to talk about their work and help them learn how to engage in academic research that way.
It is remarkable and worth noting that in his life, which began in 1933 on the 15th day of January, he saw a transformation in our country that was immense. And some battles are better than others, and some are over, but others continue, as we know. And it is heartbreaking that we're not past the issue of race. But I think it is important And that's an understatement, Shaylon, to remember what happened before the 21st century and what happened in the first half of the 20th century. And here's a man who right before 1950 couldn't get an education in Louisiana. And obviously he was not alone. And Ernest was capable. He had the ability to get out of Louisiana and go to California. But what if he had not? Look at what we would have missed. It would have been horrible.
Absolutely. I think in that regard, understanding the value of fair and open access to information is a really strong point. If he hadn't been able to leave Louisiana, he wouldn't have ever been really exposed to Southern literature, and he never would have thought to write and try to complicate the narrative that is in Southern lit, in Southern fiction. He wasn't allowed to go to a library in Louisiana because they were segregated. So a lot of people are thinking about restricting and restricting and restricting information and access to books, and I think that's just a very terrible idea because you don't know who you're going to hinder the next great mind out there because you're uncomfortable with what they're interested in.
We're talking with Shaylon Woods, the director of the Ernest Gaines Center at UL Lafayette. And as mentioned, you can reach her at Shaylon, that's C-H-E-Y-L-O-N, Shaylon.Woods@Louisiana.edu. But Ernest Gaines never forgot Louisiana. His writing, for the most part, was done in the majestic city of San Francisco on Divisadero Street, but he never forgot Louisiana. Almost all of his work relates to this state, with one or two notable exceptions, including when Jesus came to Market Street. But he never forgot our state, and without his words, I don't know that these stories would have been told, certainly not in the compelling way he was capable of telling them, Shaylon.
I agree. Specifically, as focused as he was on South Louisiana, one of my favorite things to remind people of is Gaines's excerpts from the novel A Lesson Before Dying was used in French curriculum to teach French students about U.S. slavery. And that's kind of more so the impact of it. There's a lot of things they could have used. They could have, you know, pulled things from Frederick Douglass or Phyllis Wheatley, but they chose the autobiography of Miss Jane Pittman. They chose a narrative written by someone who had not been enslaved, writing about experiences of an enslaved person, through which he did a lot of research to be able to write that. But the way he wrote the experiences of Louisiana were so compelling that people believed she was real. People would write him asking him, how is she doing? And an entire other country decided to incorporate his words into their curriculum to try to explain U.S. slavery to their children.
Well, it is more than appropriate that there is a Black Heritage stamp bearing the image of Ernest Gaines. And this editorial in today's paper closes this way. His novels would shine a light on individuals who are too often overlooked and remind us of the dignity present in every human being, especially those being oppressed. Gaines first saw that dignity revealed in Pointe-Coupee Parish, where he lived in a home intended to house slaves. He saw that light while living with a disabled aunt, who had to crawl to move around the house. Impoverished as a child, he felt the sting of attending segregated schools for the few months of the year they were open. In his home parish, there were no high schools for Black children, but his mother and stepfather urged him to join them in California, where he could continue his schooling through a master's degree. His stamp reminds us of what he endured, but also of what he created, a body of brilliant literature and generations of inspired writers and readers. His work is worth commemoration on our mail and in our hearts. And congratulations for keeping the flame alive, Shaylon Woods. You're doing good work at UL Lafayette at the Gaines Center.
Thank you.
Well, nice to visit with you, and let's talk again. I'm sure there will be updates, as there should be, on remembering Ernest Gaines, who not only was a great writer, he served our country in uniform, and he was an amazing track athlete at San Francisco State University. 440. Signature support from First Financial Tax and Accounting Services.